When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hi, folks. Welcome to another episode of Film Study. This is Ken McKusick, and we're back for part two of our review of the interior offensive line players in this year's NFL draft. Joining me for that is Michael Crawford. Michael, how are you doing?
Doing great, Ken. Really doing well. This is exciting. Glad that we're back for part two of this and look forward to getting down to number one.
So we had a number of differences in the first episode between our bottom four. And I kind of was expecting some of it because Michael does a very deep review of the draft. But we had some different players on there. We had some honorable mention guys who were on my list. And we had other guys, a couple that I hadn't looked at that were on Michael's list. So very impressive deep look at this, obviously. And I appreciate you coming on and talking IOL more than anybody, Michael. But let's jump right in this show, and the number six guy for you is who?
Number six for me is Brandon Coleman from TCU. Another guy who I like better at guard than tackle. Went back to check out some games at guard for him. There was one in 2021 versus Baylor that I really thought kind of highlighted a lot of his positives. So I noted some things: grip strength, arm length, show up on tape in terms of making first meaningful contact. Let's see. Looks for work. You know, you see good examples of competitive toughness there. Might latch on a bit too long. We talked about that a little bit, and some of the other guys were, you know, kind of having that sense about when to let go of a block. Solid play strength. You can see his basketball background in space, you know, when he has to quickly change direction, kind of has that shuffle slide, like he's playing man-to-man defense on the perimeter. Good bend for a 6'4 guy. Can sink and come out of his hips. I'd like to see him get his hands inside a little bit more consistency. Yeah, consistently, because that kind of leads to him exposing his chest and allowing defenders to kind of get control of him and control the block a little bit more than I would like to see. One thing, I didn't see this more. I saw it in this game, so maybe it's not a persistent thing, but a couple times where he kind of would drop his head and eyes just before contact, which could lead him to get beat by certain kind of moves in pass protection. Kind of got to keep do a better job of keeping his head and eyes up. But I didn't see that in some of the other games. So maybe that was just a one-time thing. Because he got hit with a couple swim moves. Obviously, if you're dipping your head and your eyes, they're going to get that arm over right over the top of your head. You're not going to see it coming. But I don't think it was a consistent thing. But interesting guy. He transferred from Trinity Valley Community College to TCU. He was born in Virginia, but spent most of his childhood in Berlin, Germany. His dad was in the military. He didn't come back from Germany until 2016. His mother's German, and he apparently speaks fluent German. So he grew up not really playing football over there. He was on a travel basketball team, and you can kind of see that in how he moves on the football field. So interesting guy who I liked more than I thought I would at guard, because I'd seen him at tackle, and I was like, it's okay. When I went back and watched him at guard, I was like, oh, yeah, I like this better.
Has not played all that much guard since he got to TCU, 690 total snaps there. My experience with Coleman was this. First of all, I saw the Ravens were looking at him and planning to bring him in for a visit, which may have already occurred by now, by the way. But anyway, he was one of their guys for that. And, you know, they're looking for tackles. Maybe they're looking for a guard also, but they're certainly looking for tackles. And look to me like they probably wanted him at tackle. Coleman's really good year was 22 when he played left tackle. In 23, he wasn't as good. He played a little bit of guard, a little bit of tackle. And he played more guard in 21. And I don't know whether you're looking at 21 or 23 to see him at guard. But 23 at TCU did not work out so well for him as a season. But he was a lot better at guard, I thought, in the first part of the season than he was at tackle in the second part of the season, where he had a lot of pass blocking problems.
Yeah, when I looked at his measurables and I saw those 34-inch arms, yeah. I thought of you immediately.
yeah, there you go. And it's not just the low 34s either. He's in the, yeah. I think, 34.625 or whatever. That's rarefied yeah. air. But I got to say, he's not a guy who uses his arm length particularly effectively.
Yeah, and that's the key with arm length. It's like, it's great. It certainly can be an asset, but the can be is the key yeah. part of it. They're guys who have really, and we've talked about this before, your DJ Flukers, your guys with super long mm-hmm. arms who don't necessarily use them super effectively. And then guys with shorter arms, like your Patrick McCarries, who are able to kind of sustain, right? I know there's this whole debate about Patrick McCarry and whether people put him up too high or they put him down too low. He's a sustainable kind of guy. That's how I always describe him, right? In a pinch, if you need a guy to go out and get you through a game at tackle, you know, he can do that. Is it ideal? Is it great? Yeah. Debatable. Depends on who you ask, but he can get you through a game. But I like those two ends of the spectrum. The guy with like super, super long arms who didn't necessarily use them really all that effectively, and a guy with shorter arms who just finds a way to make it work.
Well, the Ravens are notorious. They're as bad as I am for wanting long-armed offensive tackles. And McCarry is the exception to that, but they've had a whole bunch of other guys who've been long-armed. Hurst would be another exception, by the way. UDFAs in both cases. Mm-hmm. But the shortest they've gone with a guy they've drafted at tackle – really to play tackle would be Michael Orr at 33.5, I believe. So, and that really, he had some success on the right side, wanted to play left tackle, worst move in Ravens history, moving him to left tackle, getting Jared Gaither upset. Jared Gaither didn't need much of a push to send himself over the edge into the abyss in terms of some stupid behavior there, but there was no reason to push that button with Orr playing right tackle well and Gaither playing left tackle well at that point.
Yeah, that'll be another fun discussion for another day. That stuff off the top of your head. I look back this past season, as I mentioned in part one, I went back to 2 years before Harbaugh got here and then worked mm-hmm. all the way back up, just looking at the different offensive line combinations and how guys were acquired and how they moved and the positions they played each year and the stories that all those numbers tell and the information tells. It's really fascinating stuff to me. It's really fun to look back at that.
Well, let's see if Coleman is a guy that the Ravens end up drafting. I plan to include him on the tackle list. He'd probably be an honorable mention there because there's certainly enough tackles to fill the top 10 without Brandon Coleman being part of it. And I honestly think Coleman might be a guy either they're looking to get as a late-round developmental tackle or maybe even an undrafted guy. You typically would not take the chance on bringing the guy in for a workout if he's going to be one of your priority undrafted guys, I don't think. But there's going to be a lot of people who are going to be scared away by the 2023 season in terms of what happened to him at tackle and say, we're not real anxious to do that, even though the measurables seem to be pretty good.
Understood.
All right. I'll give you my number six guy is Cooper Beebe of Kansas State. Don't know if he's on your list or not, because somebody who's on the list, I believe, might not be, but let me get down to my notes on him.
He's on mine. He's my number four guy.
Your number four guy. Great. 6'3", 322. He'll be 23 in May. That's actually fairly young, not super young, but it's not old either for the interior offensive lineman. He's got very short arms at 31.5 inches. That's fine on the inside here. Significant play at offensive tackle during his Kansas State career. Absolutely for certain a guard in the NFL level. Really good pass blocking record, 39 pressures of any type allowed in 1,488 snaps at K-State. That includes good success both at guard and at tackle, and just as good success, honestly, at tackle as at guard on a rate basis is really exceptional because you should allow more pressures at tackle. I really like the fact, especially after watching John Simpson play here this last year, that he doesn't lose his feet much. Seems to understand balance and leverage very well. He's not the kind of guy who falls for the push-pull move, and I think that'll probably hold up at the NFL level. The guys who understand balance are usually pretty good. It's not like it won't happen ever to him because it happens to everybody that a guard will get lungy and he'll get pulled down by a defensive tackle who starts to push against him, then pulls back as soon as he's on half you to make you miss. 8 penalties and 3,128 offensive snaps. I got a little chippy as I was going through this. That's one penalty every 391 snaps, which is the equivalent of 244 millisimpsons. That means he has 0.244 times as many penalties as John Simpson does on a per snap basis. Millisimpsons, the new basis on which
he's created
penalty rates for guards will be judged. Generates good leverage at the point of attack despite below average strength was my next thing. So he had 20 reps on the bench. But you know, that's not a great total, but it's not a terrible total, except when you have 31.5-inch arms, it's a terrible total. It's really a bad total. And there's some other guys in this draft who had really long arms and had very good totals, or and some others who had long arms and had 20 or 21 reps. That's actually a lot better. So BB, that's a problem. He probably is going to need some NFL year in the NFL weight room to get suited up, get ready to go. You know, in terms of what he's accomplished at the college level, I'd say he's really outperformed his physical gifts in a way that Marshall Yanda did. Marshall Yanda seemed kind of a really short arm set of problems. And he, like Beebe, had played some tackle and played some guard. He played, obviously, Yanda was pretty much a tackle in college at Iowa, but he also, when he came to the pros, don't forget, he moved to right tackle. And I don't think he was a Pro Bowler that year, but Peter King and some other people really thought he should have been in 2010, or maybe he did make the Pro Bowl. Maybe I'm wrong about that. But anyway, any way you look at it, had a great year in 2010 at right tackle when the Ravens needed it out of him because Gaither had his injury, and I'm using air quotes, when Orr had to be moved to left tackle. I think I got one big question about him, and I'm sorry, we're trying to go fast, so I'm going through this. Can he continue to excel at the NFL level in terms of stunt and blitz pickups? And the reason that might be tough for him is because they're going to target his length. And they did that with Tyler Linderbaum, and he had a very tough year as a rookie, stunts and twists, and improved greatly, obviously, in his sophomore season in terms of that. So maybe Cooper Beebe have a developmental track that's similar there.
Yeah, and the thing that stood out, I was just going to say that the savviness. Not a total surprise when you look at a guy that's played 51 games. He's not Mason McCormick level, but he's played a bunch of games. Yeah. And I watched the game from this year versus Texas. Again, good interior defensive line matchup. And the savviness was on full display. I mean, just in a maybe a 10, probably less play sequence. He's slingshotting guys. He's got the snatch and trap. He's got the Hamilton where you grab the wrist and limit. He's working all of these different moves. And I'm like, okay, this is how he mitigates the arm length. He's just going to be more savvy than you. I'm going to know how to counter whatever you do. You try to long arm me. It was Tavondre Sweat who tried to long arm him and bully him back. He chopped that long arm down and then snatched him from the jersey by the jersey down into the ground. So he just knows how to counter some of these things that people can do because they have that length advantage. He's like a boxer that doesn't have a reach advantage, but who understands because I've had this reach disadvantage my whole life. So I understand how to work within it. So I think that might give him a chance. Now, there's still going to be an adjustment. I mean, anytime you're going from college to NFL, like you mentioned with Linderbaum, there's going to be an adjustment period for sure. But he's BB, like Linderbaum, is one of those guys I would bet on to be able to come out the other side of that.
All right. So he was your number four guy and my number six guy. Let's go on to then your number five guy, I guess, is next, right?
Who we've already talked about because he was your... It's Dominic Puni. I forget what
Dominic Puni. Okay. And I had Christian Mahogany at number five, and you had him a little bit lower down, maybe number seven also, or eight.
Yeah, he was eight. He was eight for me. Yeah. So that's why this is going to speed up, just because
we're going to get through this in record time. So the top four guys, no, I've got three guys we haven't talked about yet still left. I don't know how many you have, but go ahead with your number four guy.
Cooper Beebe was my fourth. Cooper,
okay. You got, okay. So my number four guy. So we are going to have three each of new guys. So my number four guy is Christian Haynes of UConn. So definitely near the top of a lot of people's boards. A lot of people have him as either the best or the second best guard in this class. Let me get out my notes on him. Make sure I'm talking about the right guy. A lot of these guys do run together for me sometimes. 6'3", 317, 33.5-inch arms. Solid combine metrics. So he has longer arms. He had 25 reps. That is an order of magnitude more impressive than 20 reps with 31.5-inch arms. It's just an order of magnitude different. It's not just five reps. It's five reps plus length difference. Good vertical jump in his case. Want somebody who can explode off the ball a little bit. Vertical is a measure of that. Pear-shaped build, perfect for a guard again. We love to see that. And that's one of the guys that will certainly be highly prized in this draft. Started all 4 years at right guard for UConn. So it's not like he's got a lot of different experience. And he's a guy who's been typically opening the front gate on the right-handed run game. So he's got more of that, more torquing the defensive tackle on his in his background. I thought that was one of the nice things about his game was the ability to do that. He pulled a lot as well. And he pulled a fair amount left. He also pulled some to the right. And the Ravens, here's one of the problems with that. And one of the reasons why the Ravens are not likely to get him. The Ravens have had an uncanny ability with D'Alessandris to make some really lumbering athletes into decent pullers. And Hurst, Simpson kind of fell a little bit short of that, honestly. But Hurst and Bozeman are two excellent examples of guys who you wouldn't expect to be good pullers just physically, but they turned out to be great pullers with the Ravens. I think they could do it again. But in case of Haynes, that's all out there on tape at UConn. So the team that is not as confident in their ability to develop a puller out of a modest athlete will already see that Haynes can do this on tape, and that's not going to be a negative for them to drafting him, which is kind of unfortunate because if he was a little bit less in that way, I think he'd be more likely to fall to the Ravens. PFF published something this year called stable metrics, and his run blocking stable metrics are all quite good, near the top of the class for the interior offensive line. And it was a variety of things. It was the number of negatively blocked run blocking plays, negatively scored run blocking plays, and the number of zone blocks he made, the number of man blocks he made. I forget, it was the efficiency, maybe was the actual statistic being done. And there's only one for pass blocking that was stable. But it's true pass sets that they had in there. But it's an interesting new thing that they had in terms of stable metrics. Don't know if you saw that.
Mm-mm. I haven't seen that yet. Okay. Yeah, I will admit, spoiler alert, I'm super high on Christian Haynes. He's my number one guy.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Super high.
All right.
Super high.
So let me see. The big question I had a big question about him playing in the Big East, because obviously the quality of talent, if you're talking Power 5, it's not exactly the same thing. Let's just put it that way. And then the guy I would really love to hear from is a guy who practiced with him for at least a couple of years. It's Travis Jones. Yep. Yeah. What does he think of this guy?
Yeah. Yeah. Those had to be some crazy battles in practice between those two guys. And that's something I wondered about when I went back and I looked at Jones and kind of his track record there at UConn, if they crossed over, because I think Travis Jones has been in the league, 2 years now?
Yeah, 2 years.
But they did cross over. They were there at least for 1 or 2 years at the same time.
Two, because he's a four-year starter.
Yeah, okay. So I was wondering about that. The Ravens obviously would have gone through there. Their scouts would have gone through there looking at Travis Jones, probably would have looked at Haynes while they were there. Not that other teams hadn't done that, but obviously they took a player specifically from there. So, you know, you figured that they probably have some familiarity with Christian Haynes in that way too. But yeah, I was just smitten with the guy. His tape this year against NC State is probably one of my favorite, not just any interior player, of any player I watched this year. Cause it was like, everything was on display. Everything that makes him what I think he can be was all on display in that game. So I admit I'm kind of in the tank a little bit for Christian.
You know, it's interesting, but PFF would tell you, you know, if you love Christian Haynes from that game, he was better almost every single game the entire year.
Yeah.
That's high praise.
Yeah. And, you know, again, that's part of why I don't look, because I'm like, well, I don't want to be biased in that way. I just want to watch it. And I want to see what my eyes sort of tell me. And, you know, when it lines up, I guess it's human nature, you know, it gives you a little bit of a comfort feeling because you feel like, oh, okay, they must know more than me. they have more resources to dedicate towards this kind of thing. But even when it doesn't line up, I've gotten better at that. I think when I was younger, I used to be really kind of self-conscious about that. Like, oh, wait a minute, maybe I'm wrong. Maybe I'm not really understanding what I'm saying. It still happens to some extent, but I'm more confident now and just like, hey, if this is what you see and you think that you can explain like both sides of it, like explain the positives and the negatives so that it's not just, well, here's what I saw and I trust my eyes. Well, yeah, it's here's what I saw. I do trust my eyes, but here's why I trust them in both regards, positive and negative. So that's good, actually, that maybe I need to watch a bunch more games then, because I watched that one. And I think I went back to 2021 and watched Clemson, which is kind of interesting because you got to see him a couple times against Trenton Simpson back then in space. So that was kind of fun. But yeah, I'm a big fan of Haynes, but that means the next couple of guys are probably exactly the same. We might have them in different order, but
we have, I think we have one difference because one of them who's on my list at this point, you've already named. Before we jump into the final three, what I'd like to do is go back and talk about honorable mentions. So I know this seems a little out of order, but what we'll do is we'll alternate. Give me an honorable mention player that you looked at that you think you wouldn't be upset if the Ravens drafted him, but it also has to come at a price tag. So you got to tell me, where are you good with the Ravens drafting this guy that you're, and then maybe give me like one thing about him that you liked.
Okay. Now this guy was on your list, but he's an honorable mention for me, Mason McCormick.
Okay.
He was right outside. He was number 11 for me. He's probably, and you may have already mentioned around earlier on, but I was thinking 4 to 6, somewhere in that range. 4 might be a little high, 5, 6, somewhere around there, but in that range. And the one thing that I liked about him, and I think I mentioned it a little bit from watching that Iowa game from a year or two ago, is he was able to get himself from being in some bad body positions to good body positions. It was really weird to watch it because I'm like, man, look at this guy. He's the defensive player, has gained an advantage on him. It looks like he's about to win this block. And somehow McCormick was able to twist and contort and like adjust his body. It was, we talked about Marshall Yanda a couple of times. It's hard obviously to compare anybody to how great that dude was, but that particular element of his game to be able to get in some not so great looking body positions, but still be able to win the block or find a way to at least get a stalemate in the block. Yep. That kind of caught my eye with McCormick. Like, okay, if you can do that, there's something there to develop.
All right. That's a good one. I gave lots of information on McCormick, so I'm not going to duplicate here. I'll just name you. And my next guy who is on my honorable mention is Javian Cohen, who got left off just at the bottom of this. And he's a guy, 6'4", 324, 34-inch arms, had terrible testing metrics. Kind of reminds me of Orlando Brown in a way, just a shuttle in the 9th percentile, a 3-cone in the 5th percentile. He's an apple. He's not a pear. There's really some questions about whether this guy can be able to pull at the NFL level or period. You know, he just didn't look that good, but I think he's a guy, boy, if the Ravens like him for the other reasons, if they think he's strong enough and big enough and they can mold him, they're the team that can make him a good puller as an NFL player. So that's the reason I liked him. He is big and strong, but he's a guy who just tests absolutely awfully. And I think that is going to keep some teams away.
And speaking of biases, this is an older one, because Ozzie's not the GM anymore, but he did start out at Alabama before transferring to Miami. So let's keep that in mind.
There you go. So what? Another honorable mention for you.
All right.
Oh, by the way, Javian Cohen, round 5 or 6 for me, will be a value round for the Ravens. Other people have him higher than that.
Okay. These other guys, these are little guys. I don't know if we'll do one or two more, but both of these guys are little guys. Little in, you know, relative to offensive linemen.
Sure.
Bo Limmer, Arkansas, is a guy for me. I think we've talked about him with probably a center-only guy, but does have 29 starts out of 38 games at right guard. The SEC, this is impressive. But when you watch him and you look at the body type, he looks physically smaller than other guys when you watch him. But apparently, he is a maniac in the weight room. His dad was an ex-power lifter. You know, you never know if this stuff is official, because obviously I'm not getting it, you know, directly from the Arkansas strength coach, but reportedly he, strongest guy on the team, squatted 605 pounds, benching a team best 445 pounds, during the offseason. That was at Arkansas. Allegedly in high school, he had a 400 pound bench press, 295 pound power clean, and squatted 455 in high school. So one of these guys who lives in the weight room, knew he was undersized, going from high school to Arkansas. So from his senior year of high school to his freshman year in at Arkansas, put on 25 pounds of muscle because he'd gone to a camp and they told him, look, if you want to have a chance here, you got to get bigger. And he just went to work and got bigger. And so what kind of sold me was a game from, when did I watch this? It was either last year. It probably was last year because he had some matchups against Will Anderson. It was an Alabama game. And I was like, okay, Will Anderson's an edge guy, but you know, a couple reps where he was either spiking inside or they moved him kind of into more of a 3-technique, 4-eye alignment, and he got on Limmer. And if you can hold your own and absorb a bull rush from Will Anderson, you've got some strength. Mm-hmm. So I don't know if he can survive long term at guard in the NFL. And that's probably why he's on the honorable mention list for me. But a guy who's committed in the weight room and is just going to battle you all game long, like hard hat, lunch pail type dude, I'll bet on those guys.
Okay. You know what? I have my list separated into three things. I have my top 10, 1 through 10. I have my honorable mentions, 1 to 6. And then I have my no for the Ravens. And there are five guys on that list. Bo Lemmer's the top name on that list because he's a center only. Now, here's the thing. You're talking me out of it. I'm drinking the Kool-Aid here in terms of this guy being the, you know, the power strength guy. He's a very short length is one of the reasons why he's likely a center only. But there are guards who are 31 and 7/8 that make it, and he might be that guy. I would not be upset if he's a UDFA for the Ravens who comes in. Unfortunately, I think there are enough teams out there who want to build their offensive line around a real high quality center. Mm-hmm. The comps for him I saw on one site, and this is really high praise and then low praise. How you could be a comp to both these guys, I don't know. The comp for him, the first comp was Creed Humphrey. And I go, wow.
Very good.
And
good.
The second comp is Luke Fortner. And I go, well,
Not as good.
So anyway, for a guy who's going to play all at center, I thought no for the Ravens, but you talking me into the weight room stuff, I could believe it. So I will not now be upset if I see him on the list of 15 guys or see him as a seventh round selection.
Yeah. And as much as I was impressed by that stuff, and I am, the cynic in me though does wonder, okay, well, is he maxed out? If he did all of that to be able to compete week in and week out in the SEC, is there anything left? Or has he maxed it out already? And if he's maxed it out already, that's probably not a good sign. Another honorable mention for you. Nope, I don't hear you. I think you're muted.
Thank you. Wouldn't be a show if I didn't mute at least one. Mute it once. But Kyle Hergel of Boston College would be in my next guy. And let me get down. I think what was my issue with him? He had some outstanding jumps. Really good senior season as a pass blocker. He's a left guard. Steady trend of pass blocking improvement, but it's at a bunch of places where you should see a steady trend. You should see a steady trend, but it's the places he was, North Dakota, then Texas State, then Boston College, is a good place to see that trend. I mean, he's moving up in class to do it. Penalized 11 times in his final college season is the negative thing. The NFL gives you really good information on the breakdown of the actual penalties. I don't have a site to find that, but maybe one of these massive beast guides or whatever will have that information. And if I looked at it as a bunch of false starts, I'd probably feel better about it than if it were a bunch of holding penalties or some post-snap fouls that are more costly. But anyway, 7 or a priority UDFA for Hergel. One more each. Let's do one more each if you want to.
All right. Last of the little guys for me, guy who put on an athletic testing show at the combine, Tanner Bordellini, probably another guy who's center only in the league. Played a bunch of different spots at Wisconsin, though. Played center, played right tackle, left guard, right guard, left tackle. Literally played all five spots at one point or another, at least for one game. I think left tackle was the one where he only played one game. And every other one of those spots he played multiple games at. So, another one of those kind of lunch pail, scrappy guys. Played offense and defense in high school. Not uncommon for a lot of high school guys to go both ways, but he was the conference defensive player of the year as a senior in high school. So pretty good defensive player. Track and field guy. I've always got a weakness for throwers. Shot put, discus, all those guys on the offensive line. That goes back to J.O. You probably know that story. He was a shot put guy in high school. They had when I was doing that thing, going back and looking at old guys, they had several guys who were throwers, who were shot put guys in those early years on their offensive line. I think Ben Grubbs was another guy. So they had several guys. So I'm always kind of a sucker for that. And Bordellini, another one of those guys who just, you know, was told after his senior year going to a camp that, hey, you just don't have the weight to have an opportunity here, came back 25 pounds heavier, you know, to have an opportunity. Cause Wisconsin was kind of, he's a Wisconsin kid. So it was always kind of his dream school. Went to a camp and they basically told him, like, not here. I mean, you see the kind of offensive lines we have, that's not going to work out here unless you can put on some more weight. He did it, and ended up getting a scholarship and then kind of moved all around. But it was like a jack of all trades, master of none kind of thing, I think, for him, is why he moved around so much. Not because he was, you know, oh, he's a Swiss, you know, he's a Swiss Army knife. It was kind of, nah, he's not really great at any of those positions. So we just move him all around. But he would probably be one of those guys who might be better in a really specific type of scheme, like a Shanahan style scheme where you can get away with being a little bit lighter, a little bit more athletic. You know, the Ravens, they're not, you know, completely in Greg Roman territory anymore, but I think they do tend to lean towards bigger. I mean, of course, there's the Linderbaum exception, but I think they tend to still lean towards heavier sort of body types on the interior.
It's been kind of their way for a long time. If you go back to the 1996 Ravens offensive line, it was massive compared to the rest of the league. So it's really been their way. I'm gonna toss four names out there. I'm not going to give any stuff. I'll say all of these guys, I'm happy as a UDFA. I'm not happy if they waste a draft pick on them. Matthew Jones of Ohio State, Keaton Bills of Utah, Matt Goncalves of Pittsburgh, and CJ Hansen of Holy Cross. And they're all pretty much lottery tickets at this point. I wouldn't count on any of them to stick. Any one of them could be a priority guy. And the Ravens, I wouldn't say they probably end up getting one of them, but I'd say there's usually one of the top offensive linemen available. And last year was Tayshaun Manning, who isn't really draftable, ends up coming to the Ravens. And it would not surprise me if they get somebody in this UDFA group of Hurgle, Jones, Bills, Goncalves, and Hansen to be the guy. All right. We ready to move back on to number three, I think, right?
I think number three.
Haynes is my number four guy. Your number four guy was BB?
BB.
Okay. So your number three guy is who?
Number three guy, JPJ, Jackson Powers Johnson for me. Looks the part, right? I mean, if a guy 6'3", 328, you know, wide, you know, mass type of guy, young guy, if I have his age correct or what is reported is correct, 21 years old, I think is what I saw out there. Hasn't played a ton of games. I want to say he started 16 and 32 games at Oregon, but, you know, he's moved around a little bit, has done center, has done right guard, one game at left guard. To me, when you watch him, he is a power player, right? He wants to, you talked about Joe D and using torque as a verb. Mm-hmm. You're going to see plenty of torque when you watch it, because that's what he does in terms of how he wants to finish blocks. And, you know, finish is one of those terms that we throw around. And a lot of times people hear it and they think it's got to be a pancake and you got to be like, you know, driving a guy into the ground or running him into the bench. And there's all different types of ways to finish. But sometimes a finish is just torquing a guy one way or the other to define the hole better for a ball carrier, or to create leverage as a pass protector to one side of the pocket or another. You don't have to necessarily throw the guy on the ground for it to still be a good finish.
And maybe add one thing that I like to see in a finish is your opponent is upset with you. That's a good finish to me.
Yeah, well, we talked about Zach Fraser. He had a bunch of guys who were like that.
Yep.
they were just mad at him. But, you know, JPJ, another one of those guys who, you know, wants to play that way, right? He wants to be a tone setter. Mm-hmm. He wants to kind of dictate the things that way. You can see that in just the way that he finishes blocks. And I think it might even been Joe D, who I heard, it could have been another offensive line coach, who said, you know, finish, very simply for him, is you finish what you start, right? You started the block, now finish the block. Right. This is a simple way. Now, there's a lot of different ways to do it, but in his mind, start what you finish. And I think you see that with JPJ. But I talk about that Mahler mentality, like the way that he came out of his hips and redirects force. You know, he'll lift it, right, and torque it. Sometimes you'll see guys who just try to absorb it. And, you know, depending on your body type and lower body strength, that kind of stuff, maybe you can do that. But that's hard to do consistently, going to be even harder to do in the NFL. So typically, for guys who I think do it a little more effectively, they find a way to redirect the force and not just absorb it, right? You can lift it, you can turn it, as opposed to just taking it and trying to sit down against it. Because I don't think you can do that consistently in the NFL against the monsters you're going to see on the inside. So it was encouraging to me that, you know, he was able to sort of employ some of that. But he can anchor. You definitely can see his blank strength, his play strength if he needs to sit down and anchor. And another thing I liked about him, and I probably had this note on a couple other guys that I didn't get to, controlled athletic ability to connect on blocks at the second level and in space, right? It's one thing to be athletic, and there's a couple guys in this group who tested pretty athletically and moved pretty well. But sometimes they're out of control with that athleticism. And I think JPJ did a pretty good job of sort of control. That's kind of been a big thing that I tried to look for this year. Not just with the interior guys, but probably all over the place. It's just, okay, yeah, you got to be athletic. And the more athletic you are, that can be an advantage, but it has to be a controlled athleticism, right? If it's not controlled, then you can actually probably get yourself into some bad positions more than in some good positions if you're out of control. So I like that about him. So yeah, I could have gone. It was a real close flip-flop with him and my number two guy, but I ended up putting JPJ at three.
Okay. So I'll start by saying JPJ easily my number one guy.
Okay.
So I love him. You know, I've got him higher. And in fact, my top two guys were both centers, as it turned out, on a list where the Ravens don't really need a center, and I'm making a list for the Ravens. But I feel okay about that. Powers could move to guard if he had to. He's actually played some tackle fairly effectively, so he could certainly play guard, I think, if he needed to. He's a guy who I so much positive to say about. We start with outstanding testing. The 30 bench reps are actually the weakest part of his testing from my mind, because he's a shorter armed guy. That's still a great number, but you know, it's worth 25 if he had longer arms. So it's a 73rd, 75th percentile number, but it's not a 95th percentile number as you would assume it was for like an average arm length. But you've got that. He anchored what was probably the best offensive line in all of college football at Oregon. They're a great group. Michigan was good too. There are the other good ones all over, but Oregon had one of the really high quality lines. He had one of the greatest individual pass blocking seasons in NCAA history, with only one pressure allowed per PFF. That just blows my mind for an entire season to have one pressure allowed. I get into some of this in the cut up I watched about just how much they avoid him in terms of things, but there's a couple of things that you really get into. Only allowed four pressures his entire NCAA career. Four pressures in his entire NCAA career. I tried to search for mitigating factors to what it was. So he's penalized nine times. That's a lot for a center. I don't have a breakdown of the flags again. I think it's probably likely it includes a number of post-snap fouls, since his season was spent at center. You don't usually get a false start there. You can. The center can be late on the ball, or forget the snap count. The center can move and out of a snap infraction. So it can happen, but it's more likely that you're picking up post-snap fouls as a center than at other position. The talent around him was very good, so it may have helped him avoid some mistakes. Now, I looked at the cut-up, and I got over that notion pretty quickly. I think he's the great player on that line who's helping out guys to either side of him. He was in a position to shine as a climber on combination blocks. Did that very regularly well. I think a lot of that is he's very good at aligning that guy and knowing when to release. Had Matt Skura on the show a few years ago. He did an excellent job of explaining how that worked, you know, in terms of you can actually say stuff to the guy next to you, which didn't occur to me, but he said it can also just be a hip bump. And, you know, the guy just bumps you in the hip and, you know, that's time to go. The really good ones know they have that guy unbalanced for the other guy. So you get him just off one pin a little bit. You know, the center's got this from this point forward. He can move forward. And I think Jackson Powers was that guy when he was a climber. He's perfectly able to take the guy on the back end of that block as well, too, which he did plenty. He has limited college experience, just 1,355 college snaps. Since, you know, the four total pressures is over a smaller base, but it's still fantastic because it included right tackle play in 2022. So right there, you got it. Now, the cut-up I watched was against Oregon State, and there are some specific things that I saw in that game that just absolutely make me shake my head in awe of JPJ here. And that is, there's nothing close to a pressure event, first of all, the entire game. There's two guys in the middle of the Oregon State line who have the unfortunate responsibility of trying to beat the A-gaps in this game. They wanted no part of it. They stunted play after play after play after play. I've never seen a progression of stunts like this, but it's all aimed at trying to minimize JPJ's effect. And he's too damn good. He understands too close. Most of these guys were crossing the face in both directions to avoid him, is what it really looked like. But that caught up. If you don't think you like him, or you think you could find something wrong with his game, watch that and watch how the Oregon State players. They want no part of him. You mentioned this in your thing, was that he adjusts very quickly to make blocks as presented. That's true as a pass blocker. It's true as a run blocker. Pass blocking, you know, Oregon State in particular, they're flying by his face in both directions. He'll take it. Okay, I got you here, and then I got you here. And there's a lot of he was making two blocks on the same play because they were presenting him to him on these crosses that they were doing. It's just it was incredible to see. And the other thing you also mentioned is the decisiveness in level two. He knows how to line up a guy, certainly, but part of why he's so good at it and why he doesn't lunge is that he makes up his mind quickly. And you can see the wheel spinning, and then he goes, okay, it's you. And first of all, the other guy probably says, uh-oh, and his eyes start to widen. But then he's targeted. He's very good at squaring that player up. You see a lot of that on screen passes. In particular, offensive linemen will get lungy. They get themselves in kind of a bad position versus a quicker player, and all of a sudden they think all they can do is lunge rather than try and reposition and try and just let their body reposition that defender while remaining upright rather than lunge, probably miss, and have actually a negative impact on the play that way. And that's why I really love receivers who keep their feet. But JPJ, probably the best lineman in this draft for keeping his feet in level two and not being lungy. So love that about him. There's no way in hell he makes it to number 30. So any talk of him being a Raven is complete fantasy. Some team will build their offensive line around him. He's very duplicative of Linderbaum. So even if they got the chance to draft him, I think they do it at number 30, or they could do it at number 30. It would be a highly criticized pick if they had a chance to take a tackle and took JPJ, even though I think I could understand why they might, because they're concerned about the guard situation as well. And he probably fits there just fine, given that he's played center and tackle.
Yeah, I mean, it's a couple of interesting things about him. It could be a chance for a reunion with Big Saleh. They actually played together last year. The game that I watched, Saleh was at right tackle. It was Washington and Utah. Watched two games. And JPJ was at right guard. So you got to see those two guys side by side. So that was pretty interesting. And one other nugget I just thought was cool. It doesn't amount to anything, but it was just kind of unique. So it was BB and JPJ who, of these guys that I saw, maybe some other guys had it and I just didn't see it, but the guys that I found who actually had snaps on defense at the college level. So BB, very few. I think he played like three or four snaps at D tackle against Baylor in Texas. I think he made a tackle in that game too. And JPJ, I want to say his freshman year, even though he was mostly on the offensive line, like 11 games, I think in their bowl game, he started at defensive tackle. In their bowl game, his true freshman season.
Okay, so I'll ask this as a trivia question, but there is one Raven who had 17 starts in a 16-game season because he started on offense and defense. Do you know who that was?
Oh, man. He's an offensive lineman. I'm sure I should know this because I just looked at a bunch of these names recently. I should know it, but no, I don't.
Okay, so it's Orlando Brown, and what happened was in the – lost to the Raiders in 2003. The Raiders on the first play of the game intercepted a pass, returned it to the 1 yard line. And then they set up and they brought in Orlando Brown as a defensive lineman, as they often did that year. In fact, he probably had six or seven snaps, something like that. But he played on the interior on a fourth and one stop against Seattle in the big comeback win, the 44-41 win. He was in there on fourth and one. He was in there on the goal line for that play against the Raiders. And ended up starting 17 games because he started all 16 at right tackle as well. So it happens. The Ravens have often had one guy on the offensive line who's used in a short yardage situation.
I just think it's a cool little nugget when you see those really things. Is. You just don't come across it very often. Plus, last thing on JPJ, I don't know the classification of his high school team. Maybe they were in a lower classification, or maybe they were just straight dominant. Three straight state championships. They were 51-1. At Corny Canyon in Utah. So who knows what classification they were in. They were absolutely steamrolling people.
All right. So
your number three guy.
Number three guy is a guy I moved in from tackle. It's Graham Barton of Duke. So a guy I think probably goes reasonably early, but he's going to go to somebody who wants to build around him at center. 6'5", 313, 32 7/8 arms. Not ideal length for offensive tackle, obviously. He might be able to survive at right tackle, but I think that based on the cerebral nature he seems to have. I think that the team that drafts him is probably going to want to use him at center, where he's a very good size and shape matchup for that position. He's got another Keegan-esque or one of those tall, lean frames where he's an apple and not a pear. Still likes to finish blocks, lunges like most offensive linemen do in level two. I think he's cited as frequently being on the ground and susceptible to a push-pull move. I did not actually see that on tape. Take their word for it. It probably means he can't be a guard, which is a consideration for the Ravens if he's really a regular victim of push-pull. Particularly well-suited for the responsibilities of either the climber or trailer on combination blocks. Who gets the most of those? It's the center. You know, you are left with a nose tackle, or you climb to level two while you help your guard to take on that nose tackle. So you got a number of different ways that can occur, but the center is the most likely position where you have those occur. His pass blocking results have been good enough at Duke, but the cutup I watched was of him getting absolutely blasted by Kamen Rucker, who is a marginal pass rushing talent, probably a late round pick in this year's draft from UNC, who had a big game versus him and had a sack and seven pressures. This is in total because Rucker is moving left and right in that game. So some of that was Barton, and it wasn't his best game, obviously. I think he moves to center almost certainly, and some team decides they want to build their line around this guy. And, you know, he brings quite a bit to that position. I think he brings a lot less at offensive tackle.
Yeah, the game for me, because, you know, I'm watching him at tackle. I think he did play on the interior earlier in his career, other than center. I want to say, did I have him for any snaps at guard? I wasn't able to find those games that I could watch.
Go ahead with the other points.
It was just center and left tackle. Yeah, so I didn't see him there. Interesting background, lacrosse player. Actually thought he was going to go to Duke to play lacrosse before playing football at Duke. He was that good of a lacrosse player in high school. People who know lacrosse better than me probably would tell you Duke has a pretty good lacrosse team. So I've heard. But that game against Jared Verse of Florida State, that was the one that I watched. I was like, okay, there might be something here. Not necessarily to stick at tackle, but just to go up against a guy who plays that kind of game, because even though Verse is an edge guy and he's got some rush moves, but he's a power player, right? That's his calling card. He wants to go speed to power. He wants to bull rush you. So to be able to kind of hold your own against that kind of player, caliber of the kind of guy that you might see in the NFL, obviously you're gonna see bigger guys on the interior even than Verse, but guys who want to play with power first and not necessarily try to work moves, they're just going to try to run through your chest. The fact that, you know, he was up for that challenge. I'm not going to say he won every single time they matched up, but there were a couple bull rushes where he just ate them and he sat down on it and that was it. He shut it down. So, you know, he showed me, okay, he's capable of it and he's up for the challenge. He's not, you know, like shrinking away from it or anything like that. But you covered most everything. He's my number two guy, so there's not a whole lot more for me to say. But one cool nugget I did find as I'm looking around, we talked about Big Duke Manyweather earlier, and he has that O-line Masterminds event that he puts on every year, where I think it's up to like 300 guys now that come there, like between college and pro linemen. Last July, one of the other guys who were in attendance was Matt Skura. And Barton went there and he said, we sat next to each other for most of the 2-day event. So it was awesome just to connect with him and get to know him more and share some advice and those things, because he's had a long, awesome career in the NFL. So very tenuous Ravens tie there, but it was kind of cool that it was probably more of a Duke tie because they both played at Duke. But Skura was one of those interesting guys for me. I remember, and I went back to look at these numbers because it stuck out in my head. I was like, didn't he have like really long arms, even though he wasn't that tall? I think he had like 35-inch arms.
No, ended up being a fallacy. Yes.
Okay.
So he did list at 35 arms, and there's no way. I mean, I think I saw later he's actually quite short arm. He's in the 32 and change range. The very first player to come on my show. Always will have a soft spot in my heart for him, but he did a great job. Explained he's having a great year. The story was he put out they put out Pro Bowl ballots for every other player. And Matt Skura in those years was not only was he playing a ton of snaps, he got some of that bonus money they give out every year. I think he was the biggest earner in the AFC in one particular year. Like it might have been close to $2 million, but certainly close at least to $1 million that he got additional. So when you're making a million and you get an extra million, that's not insubstantial money, obviously, that happens. And he made up this really, like, it looked like almost a sixth grader had made up this different type of Pro Bowl ballot for himself that it kind of mimicked the Ravens style, but it was just a little bit different and looked like it had been made with a for kids kit of like emojis and stickers or something, whatever. look at this, but I just loved it so much in the time. And he really, at that time, he was on a real heater for a run. And so he came on the show, and then the worst thing happened is he fell into this big slump and he had four straight games and got really bad grades. And it was what it was, but I felt really bad about it anyway.
The film study slump, right? That happens.
I really appreciated having him on the show, and he must have spent 45 minutes or so talking about all these real specific inside football things he did, and just a great guy.
Your guy John Simpson, I think, was the guy who got the biggest payment, that the performance payment this year. I think his was close to a million. Yep. He got a pretty big one, but obviously, I think Skura would be a big fan of Graham Barton. If you were to talk to him again, I think he would probably sing his praises. So, got that little bit of a connection there. But yeah, he was my number two guy. So,
okay. So, you heard my two and my guy. My number two guy is already been mentioned because it's Zach Frazier of West Virginia, and you had him at number six or something, right?
Yeah, he was six or seven. I had him at seven.
Okay. Boy, I love me some Zach Frazier in terms of what he can do, but another center and also probably another fantasy pick in terms of the Ravens getting him. So we're to your number one guy, who
was Haynes.
I think we've already talked about.
Yep.
And my number one guy is Powers. So incredibly, we got the show done in a mere 2 hours and 17 minutes of recorded content.
Yeah, I think once we got past that, once we got to the five through one and we started to have the overlap, then things kind of naturally sped up. But I guess it was kind of fun having some different guys in that part one to talk about.
I absolutely love that. Absolutely have loved the show, doing it with you, Michael. Just a pleasure of your last year. We did cornerbacks and there was a lot of similarity in our, countdown as we went through that. And that was less fun. I agree. This was a lot more fun. Plus just talking offensive line, always a lot of fun, and doing it with you is really special. Why don't you tell folks where they can talk football with you online?
So a couple podcasts, Deep Cover podcast that I do with Chris Aguilera and Kerry Smith, Fire Zone show that I do with Denard Melton. That's a defensive only. I was going to say defensive focus, but it literally is defensive only. It's like all that we talk about there. Deep Cover is kind of more a little bit of everything. So really enjoy doing both of those pods with those guys. Probably we'll get started up again once the season starts for Fire Zone for sure. Deep Cover, we're probably going to do our bracket show that we've been doing for I think we started doing it the Patrick Queen year, the Patrick Queen draft. I think it was the first year that we do it. So kind of took a March Madness style idea where you pick a bracket, but it's only for their first round pick. So we kind of just combed through all of the mock drafts, people that have, players that have been mocked to the Ravens at that first round pick, and then put together a bracket. And then five or six of us done it the last couple of years. Everybody kind of picks a guy and you argue your case and they kind of move through the bracket and you get to the finals. And we were on a good run there this first couple of years. We ended up on Queen. We ended up on Bateman. We didn't know they were going to have two picks that year. So people kind of yeah, but you didn't get both picks. Well, we didn't know they were going to have two picks. We had Bateman. And then we haven't been right for the last few years. So we're hoping to get back on. So I think we're going to try to get that out. Usually we do it a couple of days before the draft. We try to wait as long as we can, because sometimes you start to get that leakage of information when you get close to the draft and it can kind of change things. So we'll probably try to get it out pretty close to the draft, but that's always a fun one to do. But that's it. And then of course on Twitter or X, if you are more comfortable with that, at Abukari, Abukari.
All right. Outstanding. I talked a little bit in the first episode. Please go back and take a listen to that. Some great stuff from Michael on offensive line play and some of the guys he likes that are different from mine, but also talked a little bit about Michael's background and how he looks at information, because I really respect it greatly. I will say the other guys who are on the shows, I know Chris Aguilera reasonably well. He's been on the show several times. Denard Melton a couple times. I've been on you and Denard's show as well. I know Kerry less well, but I've been trying to get him on over the years to do a show from time to time. It hasn't worked out. He's probably done one at some point. I have trouble remembering exactly that. I need to get him back on. But point I'm making, Deep Cover and Fire Zone are two podcasts you really want to try. There's some of the podcasts in Baltimore for no good reason, don't have as much of a sampling opportunity. And I would say those two shows just don't get the kind of sampling that they should get. There should be more people taking a chance, taking a listen on that and seeing how much you like this thing, because I think they're very high quality content creators, and they're not a glib and slick, you know, short and sweet kind of thing. You know, my bias is definitely towards that. You know, take as long as you need to explain that thing thoroughly, and I respect that. So, Michael, appreciate your shows and what you do for the community.
Thanks, Ken. Yeah, we understand we're not going to be for everybody, but we are for who we are, and you know, we feel like we have kind of a small niche of listeners, and they seem to really appreciate what we do. So we're good with that. Of course, you know, we're always open to new people giving us an opportunity, giving us a listen. But you know, we know it's not going to be for everybody. But if you like draft, I mean, if you like any of this stuff, definitely give the shows a listen and check it out. But since we're talking draft and it's, you know, topical right now, if you like anything that I do or that I say, Chris Aguilera at Chris Just Joking on Twitter, 10 times better. At least 10 times better than anything that I have to say. That guy studies the draft all year round. I come in January, February, like a tourist, and show up. And, oh, look at this. Look at that. He's been doing this all season long, usually from the prior. Like, he starts out in the summer looking at guys coming into the current year. Oh, I saw this guy back. Chris follows it like nobody else. So if you like draft stuff, definitely tap in with at Chris Just Joking on Twitter. He put out a couple videos this year. I think he did an offensive line early one, offensive line video earlier this year with like top 12 or 15 guys. So you can definitely check that. I think it's on our blog, deepcover.blogspot.com or something. I'll tweet it out, and you know, anybody who follows me can check it out there. But yeah, Chris way better at the draft because he's just like seriously committed to it.
Chris is coming on the show to do what'll be pretty much our capstone show for this. It'll be the offensive tackle group. On about April 16th, we're recording that. So it'll be as close to the draft as we can possibly make it. Still should have good exposure before the draft, but really looking forward to that discussion, just like we enjoy the discussion here today on the interior offensive line. Other folks out there, if you'd like to be on a film study short, hit me up. DMs are always open on Twitter. I want to hear from you. In particular, if you want to have draft content, either post or pre-draft stuff, hit me up. Let's get that on the schedule now, because we're getting tight on time, particularly for anything that has to be pre-draft. If you want to talk analytics after the draft, trends in this year's draft, whatever it might be after, we'll have opportunities for that. But hit me up now so I can start to plan for when that content gets produced and still remains timely, because that's the key, of course, for what I'm putting out. But anyway, I also have the recollection show. So if you want to talk about one particular Raven who was a favorite of yours, I'm really lacking people who know anything about the pre-2000 Ravens. That would be great if you wanted to do one of them. The only guy we've had really from pre-2000 so far is Qadre Ismail, who just leaks over in 1999. But otherwise, I don't think we had a single player who's pre-2000. So hopefully some folks can come up with that. Michael, thanks again for coming on.
Appreciate you having me, Ken. It's always a great time, and I hope folks enjoy this.
And we'll talk to you next time on Film Study.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.